Welcome to the InnovaBus podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't yet joined our wonderful Flywheel Nation community, go to flywheelnation.com and join in the podcast conversations. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast. In today's InnovaBuzz episode, we're diving deep with Larry Apke, the man who's turning the chaos of our VUCA world, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, into a playbook for groundbreaking success. Forget survival. Larry's agile approach is about thriving in a whirlwind of change. He's not just talking theories, he's leading the charge with Job Hackers, offering life-changing education for free. If you're ready to master your professional landscape, make indispensable strides in your career, or revolutionize the way you tackle daily challenges, this conversation is a must listen. Larry's insights can be your guiding light, illuminating the path to navigate uncertainty and thrive. Buckle up. This is the episode that changes everything. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited today to welcome from sunny, as he was telling me, the Bay Area near San Francisco in California, USA, Larry Apke. Larry is a VUCA consultant, he's an agile coach and the founder of the Job Hackers, where he's made a significant contribution to education and professional development through innovative free agile training. So looking forward to learning all about that. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Larry. It's a great privilege to have you here as my guest.
Well, thank you, Jürgen. It's a privilege to be your guest, and I'm very excited about getting the opportunity to speak with you today.
Wonderful. Now, with a long history of facilitating one of the, I don't know how long it was, but it's a very rich history of facilitating one of the largest agile transformations at T-Mobile that you wrote extensively about in your blog, and also offering that free training I mentioned, over 6 million, I think, is the estimated worth of that to over 4,000 people across 50 countries. So, with all that work in agile coaching and really pushing the boundaries of that, I'm really looking forward to kind of digging into that some more. Now, as we dive into that discussion, what's the impact you're hoping to make in the world, Larry?
Well, I think the biggest impact that I can make, and it's what I concentrate really on my training and where I'm putting most of my effort these days, is I'm going to talk a lot about how we see the world being so important to us and our success as human beings. So the thing that I am trying to do each and every day, whether it be with clients or with my classes, the nonprofit that I ran, it's trying to help people see the world differently, and by doing so, increase their chances for success. And so that's the real big thing for me. And I get most excited, and this is why I love to teach a class, is you can see the light bulbs going off. You can see what you've made an effect on others. And it's really, really gratifying, and it's a really a big hit of dopamine, and it's really, really addictive. And so that's generally what I'm looking for in my work.
Okay. When you say see the world differently, can you expand a little on that for me?
Yeah, we as human beings, the thing that I like to talk about is we evolved over millennia in a world that was quite different than it was today. The world that we live in today is something that can be described in a number of ways, but one of the ways that was used recently was the term VUCA, the acronym VUCA for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And I think most of your you know listeners and viewers are going to resonate with the fact that the world is changing at an increasing rate. We don't really know where things are headed, but we know that they're changing. And so this is kind of this VUCA world that I speak of. And we evolved in a world that didn't change a whole lot. We evolved in a world that was based on physical labor and not so much intellectual labor. That we have today. You know, most people today are knowledge workers, not physical workers. And so we see the world in the ways that we were evolved to see the world and the way that the world was seen over millennia in the way that we teach, instruct, et cetera. And it's not that these are bad. There's no bad or good in this world. It's just some things are more successful than others. And being able to see the world differently and to see the world for what it is and today and not what we evolved for does make a difference. And because our intuition comes from this kind of physical world, a lot of what happens in this VUCA world and the things that we need to do to be successful or optimal is the word I like to use, they're counterintuitive, right? Because our intuition was built in a different world through, you know, mental evolution, through education. So that's when I talk about seeing the world differently. I'll give you an example from software development. When I first heard about pair programming, and I'm sure that some of your folks are probably familiar with this concept of pair programming, it's very counterintuitive. It doesn't seem to make sense from an accounting standpoint that I have two people doing the same thing. But what we found in software development, that it actually produces better quality, higher quality software. And over the long run, it is actually cost effective. There are numerous examples, that's just one, that we find in this VUCA world that are counterintuitive. And therefore, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help people understand those things that are counterintuitive and that would help them to be, again, optimal in this world.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? The idea that there's this dramatic transformation perhaps over the last 20 years from sort of physical labor into intellectual skills and intellectual way of working. And yet at the same time, and I was having this conversation with my wife recently, where at the same time it's some of the physical skills, like the trade skills, like carpentry or specific trade skills involved in, particularly in the building trade, are really in demand today, and not a lot of people wanting to go into that. And I know from a consumer of that, if I want some work done around the home or I need some maintenance done on lights, for example, it's very hard to actually get an electrician to come around and do those small jobs because they're in such high demand doing much bigger jobs that they're not interested in the little stuff.
We saw that in the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
When we went into the pandemic, I don't know if y'all had this in Australia, but we called folks essential workers, right? And essential workers went back to work, and the rest of us, most of us knowledge workers, we worked over Zoom and we worked at home. And the essential workers were the folks who were mostly doing physical work. So again, you know, the funny thing about this world is you have to start looking at it. You got to say, wait a minute, that doesn't seem to make sense, but it does. I mean, because we can't give away our physical bodies and the things that affect us on a daily basis. The most are the things that affect our physical bodies, you know, and so that the people who take care of those things, healthcare is another example of, you know, kind of.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
These are the people that, you know, we're seeing a lot of layoffs in tech. And you can see that because, again, these are not people who are doing necessarily physical things that you can see the immediate effect of what they're doing. It's only over time that you see them. And again, so it becomes counterintuitive.
Hmm. Yeah, it is fascinating, isn't it? And I think the example you raise of the health workers is really an important one. I mean, the thing I was thinking about, going back to what you said earlier about some of the labor jobs disappearing because, well, for example, they're being done by robots now, but somebody's actually got to physically build that robot because it's still a physical entity, right? And whilst there's probably a very high level of skill involved in building the robot once that person's been given the plans, it's still a physical job.
Right, absolutely. My wife works for a company that builds surgical robots.
Yeah, right.
Good example. Because they just released their new, you know, their new robot. But there are still physicians who are working those robots. So the interesting thing to me is we look at the major changes that are going on as we speak today, which are very disruptive in some respects, which is AI, which is on everybody's mind and everybody's talking about it. This is obviously something that's contributing to the VUCA in the world. The whole AI thing is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. But there will be people who will have to do things with AI, right? So the question is, you know, people keep asking me, well, how's it going to affect the world? I said, well, it's the same thing that the steam shovel did, right? The steam shovel did the work of 10 people with a shovel. So now I don't need 10 people with a shovel. I need somebody who can run the steam shovel. So the skills will change, and they're always changing, that are necessary to be successful in the world. My biggest concern is the amount of productivity gained with each innovation, in this case AI, has the potential, and I think it probably will, to disrupt the labor force for quite some time until we can catch up to what's going on. And if I only need one person to do the work of 10, what do I do with the other 9 people is always a question that we probably should keep top of mind.
Yeah. Well, coming back to that education piece then, and the impact that you talked about in terms of getting people to change their thinking around the world we live in today, and given those developments. I mean, AI, it's just amazing what is happening, and we're only scratching the surface, and each of us individually is probably only seeing a very small part of what's going on in the background in terms of where this is headed and what's being developed. So what can people kind of do that are feeling this uncertainty and are feeling as though, oh, I don't know whether I've got a future in whatever it is I'm doing? How can they approach that, and what are some of the steps they can take to change their mindset first, but then, you know, what are some specific actions?
Well, I always think, you know, we always say the word education and we throw that out there like some universal sob for every ill that we have. But the answer to a certain degree is education. I think one of the things that we need to do is it really helps when we start to acknowledge the world as it is. If we acknowledge the world as VUCA, then we have to ask ourselves, okay, what are the things that I can do in the VUCA world? And there's some what I would consider universal skills that are necessary. And they're interesting skills. It's a hodgepodge of things. But the number one thing I would say is feedback. Fast, accurate, and actionable feedback. So I'm going to look at things like as much as possible like a system. I'm going to look at the various parts of the system, and I'm going to ask myself a question. Okay, how can I get feedback from the system so I can know what it really is? I know that's kind of abstract, but do it in the world of agility or agile in different ways. And this is, if you look at the frameworks, the predominant framework being Scrum. Scrum is a series of feedbacks that are set up to a time cadence. So if I have a 2-week sprint, every 2 weeks I do a sprint review. What is that? That's feedback. I do a retrospective. What is that? That's feedback. I have a daily stand-up. That's feedback. And if we understand that these are merely feedback mechanisms that keep us safer in a world that's constantly changing, that's great. The second thing that we kind of have to have is, and this is, a, you know, people call them soft skills, but they're the hardest ones, is we really need to have almost a radical humility in face of the world. I believe we as human beings feel that we have more control over the world than we do. And we don't necessarily put the control where we, you know, I think it would be best put. And in this case, it is. It's continually trying to see how the world is, not how I want the world to be. So in my class, I teach a lot about biases because we got a ton of them as human beings. Yeah. And those biases get in the way of what we do. And one of the biggest biases in this case is confirmation bias. We look for evidence to support whatever we believe at the beginning. We need to have the humility to say that I am probably in this VUCA world, I'm probably wrong. I always say that's a superpower. Just assume you're wrong about everything. Because then I'm going to set up the feedback mechanisms necessary to either prove that I'm wrong or, which is science. That's how science works, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What we're supposed to really do in science are the things that we should do in our lives, which is the null, you know, try to prove the null hypothesis, try to prove we're wrong. And if we can't, then there's probably something there. Because if we do that, then we're not going to get caught with our biases, which are huge, huge blind spots. So, you know, a lot of this sounds kind of strange, but this is the kind of things that I talk about in my classes, because I know when we start doing such things and looking at the world slightly differently, I mean, assuming we're wrong, I think is slightly different than most people do. It actually has a benefit to us. Being humble has a benefit to us. Being open has a benefit, you know, to things has a benefit to us. When we talk about innovation, you know, I was excited to be on the show today because when we talk about innovation, it's the same things in innovation, that openness and humility that really helps us to see the world differently. That's what innovation is, right? It's seeing the world differently. And the most innovative people are the people who saw things differently. And the most innovative products that we have get us as consumers to see the world differently. I mean, think about the iPhone, you know, think about smartphones. We see the world fundamentally differently because we have this device. But somebody had to see that world differently before they, you know, before they invented it. Right. And so
that's right, anyway. Because there's nobody. Yeah, it's a little bit like the Henry Ford quote, right? What people wanted was a faster horse or faster carriage.
Faster, horses, right?
Faster horse and carriage. Yeah, yeah.
And somebody has a different vision. Different vision, right? And that's a big part of my training is, look, if you look at the world differently, it's going to have a huge benefit to you. And what I refer to as, you know, science, I think we call it mental models is probably the most apt phrase. I call them lenses. The different lenses that we take and with which we view the world change the world as we see it. I mean, in my class, I talk about the microscope. Think about the world before the microscope, right? Yeah, yeah. We didn't wash hands because we didn't see the germs. And I'm not saying just because we got a microscope, we started washing hands. But when we can start seeing the world differently, our whole perception changes. I mean, we thought that the Earth was the center of the universe. Boy, it changed a lot of things when we found out it wasn't, right?
Yeah, that's right. And there's so much we still don't know, probably.
Right. That's why the humility of the true scientist in really trying to go at the world scientifically is a huge benefit to anyone who's trying to be more successful in this in the world that's changing as much as it's changing today.
I'd probably add to what you said there. I mean, the humility, I think, is almost a prerequisite for what I'm about to say, and that's sort of setting ego aside. And certainly, you know, the scientific method, I was trained in that because my background is in science, and it's always, okay, well, it's not about taking a risk or being afraid that this might fail. It's about, okay, here's a hypothesis. Here's the experiment to test that hypothesis. If the hypothesis turns out to be incorrect, then, that's quite all right. Why what's wrong with the hypothesis? How can we modify the hypothesis? What experiment can we do to test the modified hypothesis? And okay, we keep repeating that. So that's kind of the scientific approach. But even in science, there's lots of examples of people faking results to achieve a certain outcome, which I think that ties back into the ego bit again, right? I put forward my hypothesis, so I'm going to do everything to prove it's right just to show you how wonderful I am, right? So we've got to leave that aside as well.
It's ego, but it's also incentives. This is the other thing that's really interesting about the world and a great deal about what I talk about. And this gets a little closer to some of the coaching that I've done recently. People will focus on the things that they're incentivized to focus on, mm-hmm. right? There used to be an old phrase, what gets incentivized gets done. I changed it or I read it somewhere differently because I think really what gets incentivized gets our focus as human beings because mm-hmm. focus is really essential to our success as well. What do we focus on? How do we focus? Can we keep focus, et cetera, et cetera? And I don't think what's happening these days is helping us in that area, to be honest with you. I think we've got a whole generation of kids who aren't really good at focusing on problems and keeping that focus for a long period of time. They get everything in very small bites. But being able to focus on certain things is where incentives really do what they do. And so if you change the incentives, you'll change the focus and you'll probably change the results, the outcomes, what gets done. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that if you look at something like the crisis in scientific replication, which you were alluding to, the scientists are incentivized to do certain things by the journals and by mm-hmm. their salary and their tenure and other things to want their hypotheses to be correct.
Yeah.
And so the incentives will do that. And so when I was working at T-Mobile, for instance, we looked at a lot of the incentives of how we were building our software. And one of the things that we found is we took a project approach to building products. This is not unusual in the world of software. The problem with that, though, is a project is not the same thing as a product. And you don't do what's necessary for the long-term health of the product when you're incentivized to do projects. So what we did is we changed the funding mechanisms. And it was at least to my knowledge, the fastest and largest transformation of its kind, where we took over $1 billion that was project-based funding, moved it to product-based funding. And we did that in about 7 months. I know companies have been trying to do it for years and still haven't been able to do it. But if you ever wonder why there's bizarre behavior by human beings, one of the things I'm going to tell you is always look at the incentives. How are people being incentivized? And this happens, you know, even at a brain chemical level, dopamine being one of our neurotransmitters that has a lot to do with how we behave, and it incentivizes us to do certain things. So if we start looking at the world that way, again, this is how I'm saying, looking at the world slightly differently, I don't think it's radically differently, slightly differently, you'll start to see things that you didn't see before. And this can lead to better results, making changes to, systems, making changes to incentives and lead to better results.
So it's fascinating. One of the things that always struck me, and I've been involved in the corporate world in some of these initiatives to kind of do major changes in structure and incentive was a big part of that as well. But change is something that people can find threatening. And even today, I still see people resisting change in a big way. Can you comment a little bit on this idea of maybe embracing change, so maybe changing our mindset around the idea of change in a VUCA world and embracing change in a more positive way?
Yeah, well, that's a tricky one because if we look at, organizational change, basically we've got to have people within the organization themselves change and want to change. And that's a real difficult thing because everybody, and this is kind of strange that we don't think about it, but everybody is looking out for themselves and their family. And there's this thing that Google found in Project Aristotle and others have talked about called psychological safety. And what Google found is that the best, highest performing teams at Google had a high degree of psychological safety. There are four other factors, but psychological safety being paramount. Mm. And I think that change is going to be, at least for now, is going to be even more difficult because there's so many changes going on. I think there's a lot of folks who have change fatigue. And the people are wondering, how does this affect me? And that's going to be first and primary to what they do. So if you're going to make change in an organization, you have to, one, talk to people and assure them, if you can, that they're safe to do something different, do something new, that the change is positive and it's going to affect them positively. Because the most people care about the organization only insofar as it affects them, organizations shouldn't be surprised about that. I mean, we're here in the United States right now. There's a lot of folks getting laid off, right? And they may have felt safe, but they're going to feel less and less safe. I mean, as time goes on, so you've got to have that safety if you're going to have change. If not, you're going to be swimming upstream. It's just very, very difficult.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point about that psychological safety and having that space where, you know, coming back to what we were talking about before, the scientific method to run those experiments as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I were in a position to really want to drive change in an organization, one of the first things I need to do, and I recommend to organizations, is be very forthcoming about what it means to all the individuals in your company. And if at all possible, say, look, we value you as a person, and the change that we're going to put in may disrupt what you're doing today, but you will have a place here if you want it. Hmm. Most organizations aren't willing to go that far. They used to. And I think that you're going to start to see, we're not in the midst of it right now, you'll see kind of a backlash. People are, there's so many changes coming so quickly that people have not only that fatigue, but they're like, what's the point? Mm-hmm. Unless they can see how it personally affects them, it's no good, which is why my training is what it is I'm not coming in and saying you need to do this, this, and the other. I'm just saying, hey, it would probably behoove you as an individual, it probably behoove you as the organization to start seeing things differently. And the people who take my class, the individuals who take my class, see that benefit. They say, yeah, this is something that personally is of benefit.
Hmm. Yeah, the change fatigue is a big one. I know some of the times we were going through reorganizations, there was a period where it seemed to be happening every couple of years, and it was like, okay, what's the flavor of the month this year or this month? It was like, change fatigue.
You have to understand the environment you're in when you're trying to make change. Because, you know, I've been brought in on agile coaching jobs where I talk to the people there and they say, well, you know, you're the fifth wave. We've tried this four times before.
Yeah,
you haven't succeeded four times before. What's different about this time? And the chances of you getting that critical mass that you need in order to make that change gets tougher and tougher over time. So, I mean, one of the things I talked to people, you know, companies came to me and they said, well, how do we change? And I said, well, you may not be able to. You may have a history, you may have a culture, you may have something that you've created, whether it's you or, you know, your predecessors, doesn't matter. You are where you are. Mm. Sometimes you have to create something from scratch. So one of the things that I mentioned to people is maybe you need to create a different organization, a new organization from scratch, and build that organization up from the ground up, because you have too much baggage in the previous one. I see it all the time in my neighborhood, where there's an old house that it would cost more to fix.
Yeah.
And they just knock it down and they build a new one. Well, they knock most of it down here in the Bay Area, because you can't get a permit for a new house, but you can get a permit for a remodel. So they'll knock it all down but one room. But they're basically saying, look, we can't do anything with what we have here. We need to start all over from scratch. And there's something in that for organizations to recognize, is that maybe what's going to happen needs to happen outside of the organization. You look at, I don't know if it's still happening as much as it was maybe 10 years ago, but Amazon had Amazon Labs, and they're still pretty innovative. Walmart had Walmart Labs. I know these because they're all here in the Bay Area. Large companies creating kind of smaller innovation centers, because it's become too difficult to innovate within the existing organization, which to some degree makes sense. I mean, there's a difference between operation and innovation.
That's right. And that was certainly one of the key learnings we had in some of the reorganization projects we did, was that it was better to have a completely separate team that was almost its own independent little organization.
Well, if you look at the history of agility, some of the most successful agile, you know, projects or programs or whatever you want to call it, were skunk works, right? They were done in the basement somewhere far off where nobody was paying any attention. And they were able to do things differently because they weren't bound by the you know, systemic interlocking, as I talk about incentives, which built the culture of the, you know, the main organization.
That's right. All right. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Job Hackers, which is your nonprofit initiative that has had a significant impact on thousands of lives globally. Now, what inspired you to start that up, and what's been the most rewarding part of that journey?
The Job Hackers started because I had a germ of an idea that if we take people who and I believe that there's a lot of smart, talented people, and we give them a little bit of education in different areas, it's going to make them more employable. They're going to be able to get jobs. They're going to be able to, you know, better themselves, so to speak. And I got the chance to do it. What I know is Agile and Scrum and that, because that's my expertise. And I got that opportunity to start teaching it. So first class I had was like 8 years ago, I think, something like that. And I had seven people in a room. And I taught them Agile and Scrum the way I wanted it taught, the way I thought it was important to teach. And then we set them out and said, you know, take the test to get certified. There's a certification test called the PSM, Professional Scrum Master. Go out and take this test and get certified. And I think of the seven, I think all seven of them got certified. And there was like three or four of them got jobs within a month. And I thought, hey, there's something here, you know?
Yeah.
And about the same time, I was down in Sunnyvale, California, Silicon Valley. And I went to this thing where it was a job search thing. It was from Nova. It's called ProMatch, and it was in the Sunnyvale Chamber of Commerce or mayor's office or something like that. I don't know how many people. It felt like 100 people or more. And these people were getting up and talking about, you know, I worked 20 years at X company and I did this and this. And they didn't know what to do, right? They hadn't looked for a job for 20 years. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to find a job. And I left that meeting and I literally almost cried. And I said, I got to do something to help them. So between those two things, I started teaching the class and started helping people find jobs. And it grew over time. And to make a long story short, a friend of mine took the class, and he was a CFO at some startups in the Bay Area. And he said, man, I wish I would have taken your class years ago. I'd have been able to save some of these companies. You do a really good job. You should do this, you know, more regularly or you know. And so he helped me set up the company. And the thing that I don't really understand where it came from, but he said, I told him, I said, it has to be a nonprofit. And I've never worked with nonprofits before. I never ran a nonprofit before. I didn't have a whole lot of experience with it, but I felt that the mission had to be primary. It had to be not about making money, which God knows if I was trying to make money, I could have made a lot more. It had to be about getting people jobs. It had to be about getting the education, and that had to be the most important piece. So as a nonprofit, I left in May of last year because I did it as a sideline to my day job for years. But by the end, when I left, and it's still going strong today, they're doing very well. When I left, we were having, you know, 500-600 people in a class from 30-40 countries all around the world who were taking this for free. And we gave away, you know, by our estimates, well over $6 million. Personally, I gave away over $6 million worth of training. And we did so, this is the kicker, we did so on a budget of about $10,000 a year. And so if you look at the impact that we made, which is what how we measured it by what do we think our impact to the world is, not how much money are we making. Dollar for dollar, we're one of the most impactful nonprofit organizations in the world, as far as I'm concerned, because even though we gave away $6 million of training, that has no bearing on the impact that we've had on the lives of thousands of people worldwide.
Yeah, that's a fascinating concept, this idea of community impact. And I've been doing a little bit of work with some organizations on kind of getting some definition around that. So I'm a bit curious, how do you measure that impact? I mean, apart from the soft stuff, you know, okay, so-and-so's got a new job in within 4 weeks as a result of this training, which they probably would have struggled to get a new job certainly in 4 weeks, maybe even at all. But how do you kind of quantify that impact?
Well, we did. We sent out surveys and we asked people, how long did it take you to get a job? How much money are you making? Where are you working? What's your title? Those kind of things. And I think that matters. But the one thing that really, really spoke to me and kept me going, because I wasn't being paid for this, and I did it, you know, again for over 7 years. And we're talking, you know, four or five classes on the average every year. And they're 6 week classes that we did in the mornings, you know, 3 hours a week. I got the testimonials. So we had this website, called, I think it's called SwitchUp, where we put, you know, we said we encourage people to give testimonials. I did all the training till now, and then there's others doing it now, so I can't take credit for whatever they're saying about the people who are doing it now. But I had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of testimonials to the quality of the class. And so how do you measure the impact? I have one story I always love to tell, because again, you've got, you know, over 4,000 people, probably now closer to 5,000 if you count after I left. And the one guy came in and we were doing a fundraiser, and I said, what did this mean to you? You know, and can you tell your story? He says, yeah, I was a project manager and I was making X number of dollars per year. I took your class. I was able to get a Scrum Master job making about $40,000-$50,000 a year more. The guy's 30 years old. So what does that mean over his lifetime? Yeah. I mean, I could do the math, right? Huge. That's one individual among, you know, among thousands. Now, not everybody has that story. But if you measure the effect for that one individual and the effect that that has for society, and then you measure the fact that, again, I spent on the average of about $10,000, you know, we as an organization spent about $10,000 a year. You know, we spent $60,000 over 7 years to achieve, just even if we just achieved that one thing, it would have probably been worth it. Right? So, I mean, it's hard to measure impact, but I don't know. Maybe, you know, it reminds me of the Supreme Court, you know, thing on pornography. You know it when you see it.
Interesting metaphor.
That's just the first thing that came to mind, but you know, my mind is not exactly normal. So,
all right. Well, I think on that note, it's a good point to move on to the innovation round, our buzz round. It's the same five questions I ask of every guest, and the idea is you'll give us some sharp, snappy answers that'll inspire the listener to do something awesome today as a result.
Sure. Well, hopefully I can be short and snappy both. I don't know.
All right. Let's do it. What's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
They need to see the world differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've discussed that at great length. So, yeah, really good answer. So think of a reframe. Think of a, you know, what if scenario. All right, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think the best thing I've done to develop new ideas is the class that I teach.
Hmm. And I'm guessing you probably learn a lot as well through teaching those classes.
Oh, I learned a ton. I learned a ton. I mean, I'm not saying just because I wasn't paid, I didn't get anything out of it. I got a lot out of it, but I didn't get paid for it.
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't money. Hmm. All right. What's a favorite resource that you use most often? A favorite resource.
These days I use ChatGPT a lot. I find it to be a very effective, non-judgmental collaborator.
Hmm. Yes. I love the non-judgmental type of it. And, I like having conversations with it, and a lot of the times I actually go back and say please and thank you, because I figure that it's learning from the conversations. So if we practice kindness, there's likely to be kindness coming back more than not. But occasionally I have been quite frustrated, and one time I was telling this to somebody yesterday on a podcast recording, and it kept giving me some information that I was trying to get out of the feedback, and I kept asking other questions, and it kept coming back with this one bit of information that just didn't fit into what I was looking for. And so at one point I said, "What's your obsession with this?" I said, "Can we drop that?" And it came back and said,
I did the same. I treat it like I would any other human being. Like it's, I won't say a friend, but somebody that I can bounce ideas off of. Yeah. I don't necessarily listen to it, nor do I listen to all my friends, but I can talk to a friend and say, "Hey, here's an idea I have. What do you think about it?" And I'm thinking this, and I even asked it one time, you know, what do you want me to call you?
What did it say?
Well, it said, I'm not a human being. You call me whatever you want.
All right, okay, yeah.
But I call him Artie now. It's a guy, I guess. Artie.
Yeah, that's funny. All right, what's the best way to keep a client on track?
Incentive. Make sure that the incentives put the focus in the right direction.
Hmm. Yeah, and we talked quite a bit about incentives earlier, so I think that's a really good point, yeah. And it's often overlooked, isn't it?
I think it's really, really strange that some of the people that I look to in shaping my thinking, one of them is W. Edward Deming, and he talks about how this is something that's overlooked so often. And I think having a knowledge of sociology and psychology, and I love behavioral economics. I think understanding the psychology of economics is much more important than understanding what I consider classical economic theory.
Yeah,
because we want to know how people actually behave in the world, and they behave in ways that are irrational. So, you know, the book Predictably Irrational is one of my favorites, because it talks about, you know, we are human and we're going to do things that are human. We're not, you know, Mr. Spock or something. So we're not human beings in the system if we're going to be successful in a human system.
Hmm. Yeah, good point. I'll have to check that book out. I'm not familiar with that one. Hmm. All right. And the final question of the buzz round, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
I think that what you bring to the world that has an impact is how you're going to differentiate yourself. And I think that impact in some cases has to be done for the good of others and not necessarily for your own good. That's kind of the counterintuitive part. The more you do for others, the more you will do for yourself. And not necessarily tying everything you do to some kind of monetary or personal gain. You will get it in the end. That's again the counterintuitive thing is if you invest in others, you will receive more in return. If you don't look for the return, if you don't make it a transaction.
Yes. Looking to focus on the service and the impact you're having rather than the transaction.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people who just go in for money, they're missing the point. The point is that we should be happy. We should have a good life. You know what I would consider a good life, and money is part of it. Yes, I won't deny, but it's not the only part, and it's certainly not the most important piece. And generally, if you affect people positively, you will generally be taken care of when it comes to your needs as a human being, and monetary and otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for getting us through the buzz round, Larry, and thanks for the conversation so far. It's been really enjoyable. Now, where can people find out more about you, the work you do, and maybe even get in touch to say thanks for what you've shared today?
Well, it's really easy. Fortunately, I am the only Larry Apke that I know is alive today, and so you can, you know, Google me. You can go to LinkedIn is a great place to link into me and just type in Larry Apke, A-P-K-E. LarryApke.com is my website address. And I also have the thing that I teach my class these days, I call the VUCA MBA. And so if you go to VUCAMBA.com, you can find some information about that, but I'm easy to find. And I encourage folks to reach out to me, and let's, you know, let's talk. I'm very passionate about what I do, and I'm very passionate about helping people. So, if people reach out, I'd love to talk to them.
Excellent. All right. We'll include those links in the show notes, of course, and really encourage people to reach out to Larry if any of this has resonated today, any of this conversation. So finally, Larry, what action would you like our listener to take out of today's conversation?
I would hope that folks will see the world a little bit differently. And the other action, I think, too, is, like I said, if you're interested and I can be of service to anybody, just reach out to me. So the action would be to reach out as well.
Okay. All right. Well, that's pretty clear. And as I said, we'll have the links in the show notes where people can reach out to Larry. So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today. Really appreciate you're taking time out of your busy schedule, and I really enjoyed our conversation. All the best for the future, and please do stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you, Jürgen. I appreciate it. Thanks for the wonderful opportunity.
Thanks for listening. We'd love you to leave a review on this episode. It will help us to make the podcast better for you. Simply go to lovethepodcast.com/InnovaBuzz and pick your preferred platform. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/flywheel and secure your membership to the exclusive Flywheel Nation community, where you'll enjoy direct access to our incredible podcast guests, engaging meaningful conversations, and participate in connection events designed to elevate your business journey. Don't miss out. Join Flywheel Nation today. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got yet more fantastic guests lined up. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.